Hello there, I'm Tim and he's John, and this is How to Murder Time, a podcast about games and things.
Hello, everybody.
Watcher.
We're back.
We're back again.
Another week.
More talking.
More time passed. Time passes.
It does.
Can't be stopped. No matter how hard you try.
Good. So, how are you?
I'm good.
Excellent.
I've been doing time travel, so I like
time travel. Yeah.
But we'll get to that in a bit.
Okay, fair enough. I'm going to start with System Shock.
Well, you're doing time travel too.
I'm doing time travel of a fashion, yes. Oh, I don't know. When was System Shock? 1999?
Something like that, wasn't
it? Yeah, definitely around 2000s. It's very early in the gaming. I think the only thing that came before that of note, really, was your Ultima Underworlds 1 and 2, which were the sort of precursors to this. And then Blue Sky Productions, which then went off to form Looking Glass Studios, decided to have a go at a sci-fi romp and to double the texture sizes as well and actually make a full screen thing. That blew my mind at the time. It was that and Doom, and Doom went down the fast-paced shooter angle, whereas System Shock went down the outstanding RPG, first-person RPG type thing.
Yep.
And then, System Shock 2, Bioshock, etc., etc., and here we are today. Is there a new Bioshock coming?
No.
No? Is that it?
Studio shut down.
Oh, God, yes. Yes, I forgot. 2K, yeah. You can trace the lineage of Looking Glass Studios all the way back. But System Shock was perhaps one of their, I think, their best. I think their crowning moment. Obviously, the Thief games were something else. But System Shock 2, not so good, I think, compared to the first one. It was a bit bogged down in RPG stats and character sheets and improvement points and that kind of thing. System Shock 1 has none of that at all. You just pick up guns and go for it. You have no character as such. You're just there on the spot. Go for it. Looting guns and the ammo and dodging all manner of mutants and robots on the Citadel Station, which is under the control of, and I have to say, it is your fault, the Shodan AI that's gone mad. A really, really good tale of computer intelligence gone insane and trying to kill us all in computer gaming. Perhaps, I don't know if it's the first or the most well thought out or anything, but certainly iconic is often used to describe Shodan and System Shock, and a very good game. I'm sure we've gushed about this a lot in a previous topic show type thing. I think we might have covered the second one, but I was just playing it again. It was on GOG for like £2.
Were you playing the special adjusted edition or the original?
Enhanced edition.
Yeah,
yes.
That's the one.
I don't know what that does specifically.
Makes it widescreen and up some of the textures.
No, well, I don't know. The bit I was recording for this, it has a sort of letterbox narrow screen mode going on with the video, so you'll probably see that. But it definitely, yes, ups the texture count. I mean, imagine what the original textures were like, you looking at this video now of modern times. There we go. You can just see a bit of it there. I mean, yeah, it certainly shows its age, but its fast pace is exciting, is frightening in places. It is a kind of sci-fi thriller horror type thing. There's a fair bit of jump scare going on. You can see probably a bit of that in the video there. That's an ambush room that I stumble into, having forgotten that it was there in the intervening decade. And lots of panicked flailing around with my machine.
As you comment on a bit
thing.
On the video, which isn't synchronised to what we're talking.
I know the bit I'm talking about, and you might see it, but
they've already seen it.
Oh, blimey, I'm too slow. Very good, though. Yeah, you basically work your way through the various decks of the station, trying to foil one machination after another of the insane AI at the behest of a security consultant from Earth who manages to sometimes get through to you on the email there. And yeah, it's very. I remember it's being described at the time as Die Hard in space, and it really is that kind of sort of fast-paced action thriller. But with a real sort of rolling, rollicking story that you never really had at that time. You know, other games around that era were very much just charged around, generic buildings with various guns, killing for reasons. System Shock, you're working your way through different parts of the station. They were sort of believable parts of the station as well. You could imagine this was a real living world, a real proper space station before it all went wrong. It's the apocalyptic logs syndrome as well. That's the classics of that genre. You find all these little blue log items in there, and you load them into your little media player and play back voice clips in gaming. That was new for this. I remember nothing else having that kind of
voice was hard.
Voice work built into it, yeah. Telling the doomed last days of the station, and obviously everyone's dead by the time you get there. Because,
yeah, they're dead, so because we're recording why they were dying instead of not dying.
You spent less time ranting into your dictaphone and more time fighting back. You might still be alive today, yeah. Yeah, really enjoying it. I'm sort of managed to romp my way through. I don't know if how long it'll take. The problem is, it's the save game problem.
Yeah.
There was no such thing as an autosave in 1999. So it was just, I can get like 3 or 4 levels in before I get to a point where I'm killed and then go, and, you know, just remember the last place I saved. You might see some of the clips on the video where I'm saving quite a lot as old habits slowly are drilled back into me. Yeah, because you've got these cyborg conversion chambers on each level, basically act as a sort of kind of in-game checkpoint, but you've still got the load game, save game thing.
Yeah.
So if you can make it to the medical room and flip the switch, when you die, you don't get turned into a cyborg and game over. You just bounce back up at this, effectively, what is a technological resurrection shrine. And it's difficult to keep track of which levels of the station. You have to do this on a per-level basis. And it's difficult to keep track of which ones you've done and remember. And yeah, so I'll get like I'll complete 2 whole levels and then get to the one above and then, oh, whoops, gone, because yep. I hadn't reached the thing at that point. Very good, though. Very surprisingly, I don't know. I mean, obviously, it's not going to stand up against modern day contemporary shooters and so on, but it still feels quite pacey, quite responsive, quite satisfying, the gunplay in this game, even though it is essentially, you know, sprites and pixels and menu base and stuff. I mean, you can see, probably you'll see in some of the gameplay, all the enemies are 2D sprites, so no matter which way you're facing them, they always look the same, and it looks like they're turning to face you constantly, which is a bit weird. You wouldn't see 3D, you know, proper 3D polygon enemies until System Shock 2. That's how old this thing is. But it all still works. It all still sort of holds together, and I'm enjoying it immensely. It's a lot of nostalgia on my part. I remember buying it, and at the time, I was sort of looking at the requirements on the system requirements on the back of the box, and it said you needed a DX33, a 486 yeah. DX33, and I only had an SX25, and I was panicking all the way home as to whether it would work or not, and it worked. It was fine. But yeah, you just don't even think in those terms anymore. You know, the idea of a hard cap on a system requirement, that just doesn't even happen nowadays. Everything will work. It's just how fast or slow will it be? How much FPS can you get out of it? But yeah, there were actual cutoffs of memory and hard disk and processor in those days.
Point maths.
Yeah, and they obviously didn't need it as much as I thought, or something like that. But yeah. Very good. So I'm still romping through that, and it's good for it. It's surprisingly, I remember it back in the day being a real mammoth task to slog my way through the entire game. Enjoyable, but it would be something you'd have to put aside time and dedication and commitment to. And now I'm sort of treating it like a bit of a 15-minute drop-in game.
Yeah,
and I'm rattling through the thing much quicker than back in then. I don't know if my own reflexes and understanding of how computer games work has massively improved in like, you know, a decade and a half.
It sounds unlikely.
Or whether I don't know. I've got no way of accounting for the fact that I'm just sprinting through this thing, headshotting stuff this time round. Whereas before it was all tentative creep to the corner, click the little thingy in the top corner to make you peer around the edge and then try and shoot a bit and then run away. And now I'm just waltzing through the place. Perhaps it's just lots of memory. I know where most of it is.
I think also you've played an awful lot more shooters.
Shooters are faster paced and more dynamic these days than back then. So I think some of those skills have improved in the time. I hope so. Anyway, otherwise I've spent a long time doing not much at all. At the moment I've blown up the mining laser against the station shields. That's all sorted. Now we've got to go off to the groves to try and sort out the massive mutagenic virus that Shodan's trying to destroy the Earth with. And then after that, it'll be the go for the bridge.
It's always something.
Sort her out. I remember I was quite pleased and had almost forgotten, in fact, about the cyberspace sections in System Shock 1.
Oh, yeah.
There was a whole separate minigame where you were flying through this grid. I don't know if any of it appears on the video, but you sort of, it's quite a simplistic sort of cyberspace representation where you're flying a disembodied point, flying around collecting spinning blocks and navigating these sort of neon tunnels and so on in order to flick switches and find passwords and data cards, which you can then use back out in the real world. And some of that's quite tricky, particularly the very end of the game is in fact a massive one of those where you're trying to fight Shodan in cyberspace, this big floaty squid thing. And that all disappeared in this sequel, which was really disappointing. There was just no cyberspace at all in System Shock 2. Real shame. It sort of lacked, you know, I mean, there's some sort of weird sort of otherworldliness at the very end of System Shock 2, but that's more like alternate reality stuff than in terms of texture and game, it is essentially just more of the same. There's none of the charm of this sort of alternate reality hacking thing that you sort of get to do halfway through, you know, at regular points, in fact, during System Shock 1. It's a shame that never made it to the second one. Mm. Would have been great. But yeah, still playing through. So yeah, I don't imagine I'll be talking about that again on the show because I'll probably have completed it by next week. It's not. It seemed long back then, but doesn't seem very long now. I'm sort of waltzing through it. I don't know.
Well, games back then seemed a lot longer.
I think that's it. I just did. Yeah. I think just the average. That was a long game for its time. But nowadays, you know, you expect so much more and all this sort of open world sandbox with story elements and blah, blah, blah.
I've been working on a thing for a thing and it's basically had me playing games I haven't played since the mid-80s. These games are a lot shorter than I used to be able to. I remember spending entire summers playing at least one of these games.
Yeah.
And no. It
I wonder if our attention's faded or we're just much faster consumers of stuff now.
Or we got more experiences with more things, so everything doesn't seem quite so new.
Or is it the games themselves are just much, much bigger now? I mean, whether they're full of, filled with interesting content all the way through, they're certainly bigger now.
Yeah, they're definitely bigger. You can't get away with releasing something you can finish in a couple of minutes anymore.
Yeah, that's classed as a sort of phone game nowadays, yeah. I suppose. Mm. Anyway, over to you.
Okay, I am going to talk about Lego Dimensions.
Okay, still going with that.
Yep, because this week...
I noticed the paraphernalia is all missing. Do you need the portal to unlock it all still? Or once you've done all that,
I completed the main game and all the stuff I got. And then this week, the next round of stuff released.
Oh.
Which, for me, consists of just getting the Doctor Who expansion.
Fair enough.
So I ended up playing through the Doctor Who levels.
Okay.
Which was a couple of hours of great fun.
It looked like... Oh, you showed me some bits of it before we started, and it looked like it was structured very much like an actual episode of Doctor Who, with like title card.
It does have the titles.
Yeah. And sort of, running through various cutscenes, linking it together, some sort of story there.
Yeah, the story is Doctor turns up on Earth during Dalek invasion. Davros is there.
Little Lego Davros is awesome.
Yeah. Little Lego Davros doesn't know Doctor's new face. There are various things in this which are obviously written before they've said anything about the new season.
Yes.
And you end up going through trying to stop the Dalek invasion.
Fine.
And
good solid story there. Often comes up.
And it uses time travel to solve puzzles.
Yes. I'm very pleased about that, actually. The idea of, proper Day of the Tentacle style time travel manipulation to get things done.
You go back to Victorian London to where they're building one of the buildings and move where the window with the balcony is.
And then sort of travel back to the present day and use it to do jumpy puzzles.
He is crossing his own time stream. Something crying.
I thought there was all sorts of rules about that.
All right, guidelines.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, it plays like a Lego game, so...
Yes, collecting the studs, bashing boxes,
so
all that.
That always works and is fun, and it's got Peter Capaldi doing the voice.
Quite a lot of voice as well. Yeah. It's not just, little bit of intro work, and then, he doesn't say much for the rest of the game.
He's talking through the entire thing.
All the way through,
And there's, 2 hours worth of gameplay?
Yeah.
Plus there's a open world bit at the end where you've got a town to go and do stuff in.
Okay, yeah.
As these Lego games ever want to have. But it's really quite fun and good, and the puzzles are interesting, and you get some nice Lego with it. You get printed Lego TARDIS doors, which are going to be quite handy.
Useful parts.
Uh-huh. And also the most fantastic Lego K9 you could make with that.
I'm dead inside and have a heart of stone, but that does look cool. Like that, it looks great.
It's almost worth buying just for the K9.
It's tempting,
Although with the cost of this set, it's easy just to go to Bricklink and buy that K9 printed piece, which is the only unique thing that's part of that K9.
Is this money for old rope? I think Lego get away with a lot.
They do. Yeah, it is quite expensive for what it is, but then
do you get a Lego Weeping Angel with it? That's what I want.
No, that's the next Lego set.
Okay, looking forward to that.
That's not for the game. That's the Lego Creator Doctor Who set.
Okay,
and that comes out in December.
Oh, so don't even need Dimensions. Okay, right.
And I shall be getting that soon. So
I'm sure you will.
Yeah, which comes with a different Doctor. Yeah, a different version of the Capaldi Doctor with the different outfit.
Right.
Because it's Lego, and you've got to get all the minifigs.
Got to catch them all.
Yeah. Yeah. So. Basically, you can play through this adventure just using the Doctor and Ideal. I didn't bother swapping in any other characters apart from K9 and the TARDIS when needed.
Yeah, well, they're part of it, it makes
sense. K9's basically just used as a way of destroying silver blocks.
Okay.
Which, a familiar thing from all of the other Lego games. It used to be bombs or stuff.
You need a character with the blaster to get through certain parts.
And the TARDIS is a vehicle you can get in which can be used in certain bits. Certain bits we can land the TARDIS and it'll go to a different time, which is fantastic. Just going between Victorian London and modern London is brilliant, or future London and now London.
Okay, so several different Londons.
Yeah, there's three different
just
Londons.
Just a one-way trip.
Yeah, you've got the Victorian one, you've got the 2005 actually. No, 2015, isn't it?
I don't know. I usually have this trouble. Yeah, you usually tell me off.
What decade is it?
I don't know.
Doctor Who will have that effect on you. Time
is relative.
So there's no spoilers, because none of these puzzles are hard. Mm. They're not puzzles, they're just stuff you have to do.
Yeah.
You can't get over a...
I imagine they are puzzles if you're like 7.
I don't know. I'm a lot more credit for the intelligence of seven-year-olds.
True.
You need to climb up onto a bus. So you go back to 2015 and you plant a tree. And then when you get back there, the tree's there and you can use it to jump across.
Right.
Fantastic.
Yep.
And it's full of nods to old stuff as well. Lots of nods to the classic Doctor Who, which a lot of people aren't going to get if they are fans.
That's good. Yeah.
Which is nice. So there's a lot of...
Because for a lot of people, Doctor Who didn't start until Christopher Eccleston, you know, but there's so much more beyond that, yeah.
A lot of people weren't born when Christopher Eccleston started now.
Yeah.
Which is scary.
Mm.
So yeah, it's fun and good, and I really quite like it. And the only caveat I have is exactly the same one for the rest of Dimensions, which is it's hideously expensive.
Mm.
Although they have done a nice thing.
Yeah.
They've added a feature, apparently, I haven't used it yet or looked at it, where you need to use a certain character with a certain ability to get past a thing.
Yeah.
You can apparently now pay money in-game, so the studs you've gathered, not real money, and use that to rent a character to get past that puzzle.
Oh, that's so much more reasonable, yeah.
Yeah.
So that really does mean that you don't have to buy anything else.
Yeah. And of course, if you're a someone who's played one of these games before, you know, the first thing you do is you find the red bricks that give you the 2x multiplier.
Well, yeah.
So that you get as much cash as you need.
Yeah.
Because, it just makes everything easier and you're going to want to get the... fill up the stud bar level.
So then you can temporarily call in a character from an expansion set you don't have to just sort out those particular puzzles, and then they'll be gone again and back to work.
Yeah, like I've not used this yet.
Yeah.
In fact, I don't know if it's in this patch or the next one, but it just gets around that biggest problem.
I imagine they must have picked up a fair bit of negative publicity over the whole forcing children to go and buy expensive toys just to complete a computer game.
While Disney Infinity doesn't have this problem,
because
it doesn't gate abilities off people,
Skylanders
does.
Okay.
It's literally got gated pay-to-play content where you have to get the right type of Skylander to go through a door and do a level.
Yeah. But with Skylanders at the time being the only game of this sort, I suppose there was no real comparisons to be made. Yeah.
And that always felt a bit horrible to me at the time, but they're never going to stop that because it just negates the need to get any of them.
Well, if that's your basic business model right there, then you can't really change it.
But what it says to me is LEGO are a lot more confident, or Warner Brothers are a lot more confident saying, actually, this is a product we know people are going to want to get for their own reasons, mainly because it's LEGO, and you have no idea how obsessive LEGO people are. If you think you've got no idea.
Yeah.
They're way more obsessive than that.
Well, it's always nice to make people want your product rather than need it. Yeah.
And so I think they can get away with it. I mean, take this Doctor Who one. How many people bought this and have no intention of playing it in the game that much?
I don't know. You only get, 3 minifigs, effectively?
Yeah, you get 3 models.
That's quite expensive. I don't know, the word expensive when applied to LEGO just loses all meaning,
it
really
does.
Doesn't it?
Because
the important
thing is it comes with 4 printed TARDIS sides.
Yeah, but...
Which you could get off BrickLink, yes, I know.
But yeah, that's for what, like 30 quid was this? 30, 40, what?
I think I paid 25 for it.
Yeah.
But it's one of those things that...
I think if you're an enthusiastic LEGO modeller, there's probably other ways to do this, or better ways to do it. It's more about the game, I suppose.
Well, an intelligent person would buy it and part it up and sell it on BrickLink. Because that's how this sort of thing works.
That's terribly cynical. Yeah. So this is an expansion, isn't it? You can't do anything with it on its own.
No, you have to have the main...
So you've already forked out for the Dimensions portal base thing and all the rest of it.
Yeah, you do, because
fair enough.
Because there's absolutely nothing you can do without it.
Mm. You end up with just essentially what amounts to 3 small LEGO figures.
Well, 1 minifig and 2 micro builds, effectively.
Yeah.
Which, yeah.
I just don't think it's even meaningful to examine the concepts of value for money when it comes to LEGO. I mean. Everyone has their own opinion, I'm sure, and in terms of intrinsic value, LEGO is just stupidly expensive. But there you go. That's what it is. No one's forcing you to buy it, I suppose. Yeah, luxury item.
Not enough people have parted out the set to know how much it's going to cost in bits yet. So I just thought I'd check that
out. Looking for market value for the pieces online?
Because if you go to bricklink.com, you can just pick up any piece and look through.
Yeah.
but people haven't parted it up, so there's no price guide.
Unknown price, no history. No. Too new.
Yeah, but if I was to go Lego Portal Gun.
Does this stuff have any secondhand value? Presumably you have to type in a code to activate it, and then that's that.
Everything gets recorded on the base.
So the physical base it stood on's got the RFID chip, and you could like give that to a friend and they can use it. It's not been logged to an account somewhere that only you can use. So these things do have secondhand value.
Yeah, they do. You can sell them.
Keep an eye out for that then, I guess.
In fact, the discs, you don't need the models, you just need the discs. And they're selling for about £3 each.
Oh, so you could just not bother with the Lego and just unlock the features of the game, because essentially the only piece you need is that circular base, and those are much, much cheaper than the rest
of it. You could play the game perfectly happily with just getting those pieces and then selling on all the Lego, or just getting the Lego and selling on those pieces if you don't care about the other.
But I don't know. Who's into Lego Dimensions and doesn't care about Lego, you know? I don't know. It sort of goes hand in hand, I think. It can be hard pressed to find people who are just seeing this purely as a computer game and don't care about the IP or any of it.
Yeah, you say that, but I think that quite possibly it's a lot more complicated than that.
And I like the idea that it's not account bound. Effectively, you can swap these on the playground or whatever and still use them. I think that's a good thing, but.
The Lego Portal Gun's currently going through the £3 or £6.
Wow. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. So this stuff does have resale value.
I just think the fact that it's able to be used in a second-hand capacity at all is a nice thing.
But all of the
it would have been so easy to type in this code. This is your piece forever now.
Yeah, but all of them
prevent second-hand resale.
The Skylanders and Disney Infinity, they're all can be resold.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because the only thing about them is the fact that on the disc or on the RFID chip is saved the information about how much XP you've got in some of those games, that kind of thing, or what you've leveled up on the
disc. Oh, okay, it writes to them as well.
Yeah.
Okay.
Which, it's a fun little way of doing things.
Right.
Yeah. So, what you got next?
I'm going to talk about Worm Unlimited. Ages and ages ago, I did an Operation Cheap Seeds thing back when I used to was so tight I didn't actually play MMOs. I just did the 2 month, the 2 week trials, and had a go at Worm Online, which is quite a quirky also ran MMO.
Very also ran.
It never achieved a vast prominence, but it's still going today. So that there's a lot to be said for that. Not all of them make it, and it's essentially a kind of back then it was like a sort of very, very crafting heavy sort of EverQuest variant type of thing, but a similar style and graphicals and so on, but with much more capacity to really go mad on the crafting of it all, digging up iron ore, turning it into tools, making various bits and pieces and all the rest of it. And also, fascinatingly, and I think perhaps uniquely at the time, it allowed you to modify the terrain as well through a sort of clever system of vertex-based tiles, which tended to lend the world a sort of quite a generic sort of look and feel. But it was a world that you could actually terraform quite extensively. If you get a shovel and you move to the right corner of a square and select the dig option, you would take up a 1 point of altitude on that corner, which would make all the surrounding, basically cause a dip, and the surrounding terrain would remap to fit that new height. And you could do that, you can level things, build roadways, hilltops as well. I mean, it was quite a slow paced game as well. It was very, you hit about 150, 200 or 300 or so skills, each of which improved by doing, the traditional way it used to work back in the olden days. But they would improve by a very small amount per action. So it was really a long-term game, a game for the patient. And I suppose, being cruel, a boring game. Quite a boring game. I certainly tried my 2 week stint, had a wander around. I spent most of the time starving to death, couldn't really find enough food to keep myself alive.
A bit like real life.
And eventually just sort of got bored and wandered off. Well, back then when it was 2 week trial. You don't get that anymore. I missed the 2 week trial period. It's all free to play. You're always a free trial person forever, and also a player forever if you've ever tried it. But I saw the potential of it, but it just really felt really hampered and restricted. And also, so two major problems. One was that it was all just really, really slow. It took a long time to walk anywhere. It took really loads and loads of goes to improve your skills in digging or whatever, even slightly. It had quite a punitive inventory weight limit thing that would slow you to a crawl if you picked up too many logs or bits of ore or whatever. But the other major, so you know, that's, I suppose you could put that all down as intentional difficulty. You know, this is a game that's supposed to take a long time, a game that's supposed to reward collaborative work. I suppose if eight of you are all digging away at the same rock face, the job gets done quicker. I suppose, rather than everyone trying to solo everything and create their own kingdoms individually from scratch. So quite a social oriented game. It reminded me a lot of Tale in the Desert as well. Similar kind of aesthetic, similar kind of, you know, collaborative, long-scale construction projects and so on. But obviously this is a bit more sort of feudal, medieval, temperate forests and grassy hills instead of sand and tombs and stuff. Also reminded me a lot of, well, I suppose it obviously reminds me of Minecraft in hindsight, but that's no surprise because Notch, the chap who's, you know, the Minecraft guy, started on this. He was one of the co-creators of this game, and this was a much more of a serious business, takes ages to do stuff, it's supposed to look realistic and all that. And I guess at some point he got fed up of that, went off and just did the old the massive phenomenal success that we know today as Minecraft. But there's a lot of the basics that you'd know in Minecraft, digging tunnels and searching for minerals and so on, building walls and houses and so on. That all exists in this thing as well, but a bit more realistic, I suppose, and takes a lot longer. So the other major problem I had back then, and perhaps one of the reasons I didn't bother subbing for it, because I could see the potential, I thought, well, yeah, maybe I could go for this, but I joined into Worm Online at such a late stage that pretty much everything had been sewn up. You know, you can walk for miles and miles from the start point as a newbie and not find any land you're allowed to do any stuff on, because it's all housed up, it's those farm fields everywhere. They have these settlement markers, which form the basis of player towns, player villages, and then you deed your house to attach to that, and that then increases the size of this big settlement radius, I think. And within that settlement radius, it's illegal to do this, illegal to do that, you're not allowed to dig, you're not allowed to make roads, you know. And you can understand why. You don't want a bunch of random newbies all turning up and just sort of, you know, making large-scale cuttings and deforestation in your idyllic, hard-working village. So I sort of bounced off it back then, but... So recently they've decided on this weird initiative where they've just bundled up the client and the server and are selling it on Steam for about 25 quid. And I thought, I always wanted to try a bit more of this, but the two-week free trial was obviously too punitive, and I didn't want to pay a monthly for it. But now I get the chance to have a go. It, as far as I can tell, it is literally the server, or some sort of slightly modified server and the client. And there you go. You pay once, and you can have it. So you run your own dedicated server on your own machine. You can connect across as a LAN. It will then run as a LAN connect option. You can see it on your LAN tab on the client, which is just your server. Set a password on it, and as long as you're running your server in the background, you start the client up, and there you go. You're running around your own single-player MMO, effectively, which you are also the admin and operator of, which is nice. That's something I've always wanted.
It's a dream come true.
It is. It's like an MMO, but without all those other people, or a monthly fee. It's great. So I'm just quite fascinated with it all. I mean, obviously I've played a lot of Minecraft and quite enjoyed it, and you know, explored quite a lot of mods and stuff, but I don't know, there's just something about the sort of realism, call it realism, you know, because you can see it going on for yourself on the video, but not hugely realistic, but certainly more, I don't know, more serious than Minecraft, which often sort of, you know, the pixelated creepers and the weird sort of cartoony icons and everything. It's had its place, but I always sort of felt that perhaps there might be something a bit more I don't know, a bit more meaningful out there of a similar sort, and this is definitely scratching that itch at the moment.
Yeah,
so I've sort of run out of the starter town. I made a big mistake. If the first thing to do is so I picked the adventure mode. You can have an adventurous map or a creative map, and I went with the adventure one, and the adventure one has a sort of implicit overriding point to it all. You're supposed to become a god.
Fair enough.
Yes, there's apparently at the very far end of presumably what is a very complex set of bootstrapping and submissioning and so on. You eventually get the opportunity to ascend to the moon and become a deity. So that gives you an overall purpose, which is nice. Whether that's even remotely possible as a single player person on your own server, I suppose perhaps it's possible if you chug at it long enough. What's more likely is that a group of friends or whatever, or a little clan or guild or whatever, could fire one of these up and sort of portion out all the jobs, that sort of thing, specialise. Some people become woodcutters, some people become miners and get really good at it all and cross-train and all the rest of it. I don't know. I'm just pottering around building a small farm at the moment. I've managed to find a mine. That was a tricky bit. I never even got anywhere near that far on my 2-week free trial of the proper game.
Yeah, it's only because there was nowhere to dig.
Yeah, I've managed to find some iron ore, which has opened up a whole load of the tech tree, and it is the tech tree. There's hundreds of recipes in there, all that need sub-components and previous requisite components. That kind of bootstrapping gameplay that I totally love about these sorts of worlds, you know? It's all very well having a massive open world where you just run around killing people, but having all the, you know, this recipe unlocks that resource, which unlocks that tool, which means you can now do this function. And I love that stuff. And it's very much in evidence in here. I don't know if you can see my inventory window on the video I'm looking at there. There's just tons of tools in there, most of which I still don't know what do. Looking forward to finding out. So, yeah, I'm quite fascinated with it all. It's really, I don't know, really appealing at the moment. I can see, it's like anyone's first go at something like Minecraft or even, you know, Tale in Desert, whatever. I can see myself sort of exploring the game mechanics to my satisfaction and getting bored of it, because obviously I don't want to just, you know, log in and then just spend the next 200 years paving everything, you know. I mean, you can do that, you can do that if you like, but I suppose the overall quest that they give you, which is the whole turn in, you know, become a god type thing, I suppose that can drive and guide it to some extent, but it doesn't give you a lot of clues. And at the moment I'm just exploring the basic gameplay of it all, trying to, you know, building a house at the moment, trying to create enough regular crops so that I don't have to starve to death, which has so previously been my only experience of the game. Yeah, it seems a lot more streamlined. I think the engine's been slightly tweaked or upgraded since my day. There's slightly better character models. The UI's a bit cleaner. They've got, you know, skin on there with a sort of leather edging. None of that was there before.
Well, we didn't have leather edging technology.
No, that's clearly more recent. And yeah, the sort of ambience of it all, the grass, the sky, that sort of thing, they all seem slightly better than I remember as well. So I don't know. I wouldn't call it cutting edge by any stretch. It still looks quite dated, to be honest. But for what it does and what it needs to be, it's as viable as Minecraft. I mean, it's a different kind of stylized, I think.
I'll tell you one thing, though. Mm. If you started up on a 1440p monitor, you aren't half peering at the text.
The UI
anything.
Scaling needs a bit of work, does it?
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah.
I gave it a go and I couldn't read anything. I had to restart it in a different resolution.
There's probably some options you can set somewhere, text size in the settings. But yeah, I just love the idea of, well, for starters, the basic premise of it all, which is essentially feudal life simulator. I quite like the idea of that, finding all the minerals and resources, building my way up and sort of working it all out. But also the idea of starting and running my own server, I don't know. I don't know if there's going to be any ideas of perhaps a How to Murder Time server at some point, perhaps. But I don't know. I don't know if there's even the appeal for it there.
I don't know how many people burnt out on it first time.
Well, how many people have you even tried it? It has a hell of a reputation as being really slow. But this is the thing. Because I'm in control of the server, and it has its console, it has a little utility that lets you control it all.
You're going to cheat.
You can cheat, exactly. There's all sorts of options in there. You can set skill gain to be 3 times faster than usual. I think that's the default, actually. And you can set the time it takes for your action bar to complete whenever you do a thing. You can multiply the speed of that up as well. I think there was a setting in there that lets you change the number of pickaxe hits against a rock face in order to mine anything. That can be quite slow and tedious. So it's an opportunity, I suppose, to take this game and customize and tailor it to your own needs. If you and a group of friends want to, you know, just spend a couple of months doing it, you'll need to crank all the difficulty level up. Whereas if you're, for example, you know, the people who actually run the original Worm Online, you'll want people to stick around for quite a lot of months. So you keep it all on, you know, 1x multipliers. The original game is still there. This isn't a kind of resignation. This isn't them giving up and just selling it all. This is, I guess, a fundraising opportunity. I think it did quite well. There's a lot of positive reviews on Steam. I don't know how many they sold, but they'll have generated a fair bit of cash from this, which I guess they're going to plough back into the main game. And presumably, I don't know about how any fixes or features or upgrades in the main game, will they be pushed out to this as well? It's all there on your Steam.
I guess they're
going to
keep
the
base together.
Yeah, so it seemed like quite a savvy move. I mean, it picked up. I was sort of reading around the subject, and it seemed like a lot of people who are, you know, real diehard fans of the original game, fans and players of, you know, Worm Online as opposed to Worm Unlimited, which is this thing. They were quite cross about the idea of it all just being sold off, you know, because I suppose it could seem to some like this was basically them giving up and just, you know, cutting and running, flog what we've got and take as much money as we can and then close. But I don't think that's what's happening, so I think the original game carries on. One interesting feature I saw is on the server console, you can designate other servers as neighbours, north, south, east and west. So basically, your map that you get, the adventure map's a place called Heavenord, and there's a particular layout to it. But I've seen quite a lot of other maps online, Google image searching, with different names, different island layouts. Presumably, you can define the map itself, you can mod the map or feed it whatever JPEG, you know, the height map details as a sort of startup import, and generate a world of your own design before you even get started. And then in some fashion you can attach other servers to your server as neighbours, and characters can actually travel between them, taking their stuff with them. Which suggests clearly then quite the idea of a network of worlds that you can travel between, different kingdoms that neighbouring each other. Because I think the original game, I didn't really quite understand fully how that worked, but it is actually run on four servers. One's a middle ground, and then there are three home grounds, one for each kingdom, and I think you can travel between them in some fashion. So that sort of functionality sounded like it was developed in right from the start. So if you're running a server and your friend's running a server, you can tack them together and then travel between them. It's got combat of a fashion. The combat is basically very much like the old school stand in front of each other and wait while dice rolls happen type style of thing. It's not very easy either. But then I got ones and twos in all my weapon skills.
Yeah.
I found out how to build a practice dummy as well, which you can use, and that will actually work your weapon skills up. So I think I just need to spend
a couple of hundred of hours.
Spend a lot more time doing that before I go and try and attack a wild boar again. I don't know if you see on the bit of video that he's spliced in there, but I do attempt to attack a wild boar and it doesn't go well.
Does the wild boar win?
The wild boar wins, yes. I think I managed a young piglet once, and that was touch and go. So clearly more time on the training dummy.
Congratulations, otherwise, you're now qualified to be Prime Minister.
Otherwise, I need to be a vegetarian, I think, probably, and not use any kind of leather or pelts or anything.
I'd just like to know how many of our listeners actually now have wild boys going in their head after saying wild boars.
Wild boars. Dun, dun, dun. Yeah, I see.
It's a very specific joke. Yeah.
So I'm quite enjoying it. I sort of bought it as part curiosity, part toy, but I'm just liking, you know, the pace of it all.
Well,
it's a kind of Minecraft, but not so sort of blocky and cartoony, you know.
It's something I approve of on a big scale, because it is putting a MMO in a position where it can never get cancelled.
Yeah, well, exactly. I mean, I don't know what their plans are for upgrading people who've got Worm Unlimited with new features from Worm Online, whether that's even a thing. Maybe this is just it. This is only ever going to be what was there now, and the new stuff is a reason you'd go away and play on the big server. Mind you, one reason you would play on the big server is on the proper one and pay the monthly is because of the community. I mean, obviously, I'm very pleased with the community in my Worm Online.
You like every single one of them apart from
yes,
one person.
There's a lot of rules and mechanisms about locking down your stuff. If you have to have a settlement sundial thing, otherwise people can steal from your house, and there are locks and there are lock picking and thievery, and there are PvP rules as well. There's quite a lot of PvP servers. I mean, I don't even know if PvP stroke PvE means anything in this particular context. Perhaps if another player happened upon me, they could just kill me, but that's not going to happen because I'm on a server of one, which is nice. But yeah, that's going to be quite bleak over the long period, and that's not the game as designed, really. The game as designed, particularly a lot of these very sort of repetitive long-term progress bar building tasks, must be better as a sort of barn raising exercise with a group of friends, you know.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Apparently you have to hit a rock face 51 times before it will crumble and become a tunnel, and you're mining each of those times. So, you know, doing that yourself takes quite a while. But if there were like eight of you stood there all walloping it with a pickaxe, you'd be through there in no time.
Or if I've adjusted my own server to it, only to take
yes,
one.
Yes, that's the other way. Yeah, exactly. You can play it one of both ways. But yes, obviously, in terms of joining in a dynamic, thriving economy where there are massive PvP wars and all that sort of thing, probably the biggest and best server to join is the official one. But I don't know what the deal is with charging for access to your server. I mean, I know Worm Online has a thing where you use real money to buy in-game currency, and that's sort of one of their revenue streams. I don't even know if that means anything in the context of a single-player server. I think presumably you either spawn that stuff yourself if you need it, or I don't know, I'm not quite sure. There's lots of stuff to look into, but I don't think they've said anything about whether they're yes or no in favour or against people setting these up as paid services on their own servers. But I don't know, we'll have to see. I had a look on the. Obviously, you don't have to. You can just connect to other people's private servers, and there's a big internet list there. Presumably, Steam takes care of all the host, you know, the matchmaking and all that sort of thing. The most popular server I saw, I think there was one with a couple of hundred people on.
You can rent them with 200.
I think the most popular server I saw in the internet tab on the connection window on the client had 150 players this afternoon or Sunday afternoon.
It's not bad at all.
Yeah, but that was the only one. Then there was about 10 to 20, 30 player-ish ones, and then there was about another 100 3-4 type ones, and yeah, lots of zeros and ones. So in terms of, you know, just rocking up to somebody else's server and joining in, I guess it's an option. I don't know if there's presumably there's ways to put message of the day on the server, and there's like notice boards and things you could put up in the starting spawn areas, and some of them will have different, a lot of them, when they put the list it on the server listing there, they'll say by what amount the skill gain's been accelerated by, and by what amount the action bar and so on. So you can probably pick and choose to find one that suits you, one that's in the right kind of speed. I mean, I don't know what those multipliers go up to. Maybe you can set them to like 100 times, and just the first time you do a thing, you'll master it.
Quite possibly.
And then at that point, you can just rattle through whatever sort of long game questing or content there is. That's going to be quite limited, I expect. I mean, they've put some sort of overall meta mission in, yeah, this whole become a deity thing, but on the whole, it's not a thing where there's a sort of training guy in the starter village who makes you go away and do some basic tasks as tutorials, but beyond that, it's not really a game where there's quest hubs every 500 meters and lots of, you know, kill 10 of these type missions going on. It's very much you setting yourself up, or you lending your aid to your liege or whatever, you know, whatever player structures you've set up within this thing. Don't know.
Basically, go make a town.
It is, yeah, make a town, I suppose. You know, it's like Minecraft in that regard. You know, you make your own content, you do your own things. And I'm liking it so far. And I'm liking not having the pressure of having to get anything done in 2 weeks, or having to get so much gameplay in because I'm paying monthly for it. And I'm liking having an entirely brand new world as well.
Yeah.
Because that was a real problem. Yeah, exactly. 2 week free trial. I log in. And obviously, yeah, everyone says, oh, you should join a clan. Go join a guild. Yeah, they're fair enough. Yeah. So, I'm not sure I'm here to pick up a shovel and become a peasant in someone else's meta game, you know? That's a hard thing to... I always grimace when I see that appear on Zone Chat in any game, any MMO. Is there, what do I do? And everyone's saying, oh, you should join a guild. And that just sort of commodifies new players and sort of reduces them to the state of resources. It doesn't really take into account the fact that...
Have you ever run a guild before?
Well, the idea that a player joining a game might have their own ideas or might want to be someone special themselves, and no one wants that. They all want this person to just work hard towards their goal.
You want a bunch of newbies to come along, mine asteroids for you, and then go away.
Well, yeah, exactly. Mine asteroids. Why? What example are you thinking of?
Yeah, I'm not thinking of any particular game. No,
I know what you mean. But the advice is never start your own guild, is it? It's always join a guild.
Yeah.
It's always put yourself at the disposal of someone else so they can have a better time, you know? And I suppose that's unfair in some regards. Some people who run guilds do take the time to, you know, fashion respected and useful, well-rounded players out of new persons. But mostly it's pick up a shovel, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
Generally, so I don't know. Anyway, so yes, I am the king of my own world, and there's no one else in it, and that's fine. I'm building a house, so there. So yeah, it's done that sort of obsessional thing that I get. So I should be playing this quite a bit, I think, until suddenly I just get bored of it all and walk away. But yeah, this is my current obsession of choice. And yeah, I don't know. I don't know if perhaps down the line there'll be some sort of server hosting twins. Get in touch, put some comments in wherever you put such things. Say if you've bought it as well, and if there's any interest in getting any kind of collaborative thing going with a select community of listeners of the show, rather than, you know, a bunch of PKing idiots that you normally find on these servers. Anyway, I'm going to pass back to you.
Okay, I'm going to talk about Anno 2205.
Oh, God, I've totally missed that, yeah. I know, I heard it was sort of there coming.
Right, you played previous Anno games.
I had Anno, the one where it was all flooded and you had...
Okay, the Anno previous sci-fi one.
Yeah, whatever the... Was it 2025 or something? 2025? Something like that. Whichever. Well, the previous one, yes.
This game is incredibly similar, except it's dumbed down.
Dumbed down. That's not a bad thing, I think. I don't know. Obviously, I'm speaking for myself and not fans of the series, clearly, but...
It does interesting things, this game. It's an Anno game, so basically what you're doing is putting down buildings on an island to make money.
Yep,
for reasons and follow a plot.
Each of these buildings produces a thing that another building needs to make another thing, and
plus
so
point,
on.
Plus point, bad guy's Paul McCann.
Oh, right.
That got massive. Yeah, it's at least 5 on the score for
that's
me.
That's quite good, yeah.
It does some interesting things with placement, which I'll get to in a second, but when you're putting stuff down, you've got the... You put down enough people, you need food for them.
Mm-hmm.
You upgrade the people, you'll need better food for them and
yes,
other things.
They have more complex
so
needs
the whole
as they
mesh
become more
that comes together.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
But the difference is, there are 3 different environments that you live in. There's temperate, which is totally free building, build wherever you want on the island, grow whatever you want, have as many people.
Okay.
There's Arctic, where you have to build next to a heat source. Now, the heat source is the industry buildings. So you put down a canning plant, for instance, and you can build houses around that. And the houses won't live outside of the heat area.
Okay.
But other buildings can.
Well, that's sort of covered by islands in the previous game.
Well, you've got
it?
Islands in this game.
All right, yeah.
The temperate is all on islands. Hmm. But so this means that you have to be very careful in planning out how you're going to put your clusters of houses to get people living. And then there's the final one, which is on the moon.
Right.
Where you're living,
must be challenging.
Yeah, where you're living in a crater.
Right.
Or a series of craters. And so in this one, you can only build where you've got a force shield bubble.
Right, yeah.
So you're having to plop down force shields to expand using a bubble, your sphere of influence, so that you can build further.
Okay, yep.
Which is interesting, and it each one of those opens up interesting ways and means of exploiting the different environments. Like, your temperate islands are going to be where your main money earning ones, because you can just put down loads of people and make loads and loads of money. But you're going to want your Arctic one to be producing very specific goods, and this is where it gets interesting. You can trade them between your different areas. So stuff that's created on the moon, you can trade that back down to your temperate area, so you can upgrade your people more, or you can send stuff to the moon to keep them happy. And everyone's got that, you know, you need X number of things to be happy.
Yeah.
And so you're constantly balancing what you're sending between each area and tweaking each area to make it produce enough of the stuff so that everyone's happy and you're making loads of money.
So it's fundamentally still a game about creating and maintaining systems.
Yeah, it's all systems.
That's the core gameplay.
It's pushed it out to all the different levels in the game now interact with each other on this trade screen.
Okay.
Which is very interesting. So you'll be overproducing vitamin juice.
Yeah.
And because you desperately need to send it up to the Arctic area so that they can be happy and actually have vitamins and not die.
Yeah, I mean, I think that was handled in the previous game because each island could only grow certain sorts of resource and you had to keep sort of ferrying stuff backwards and forwards between different islands and so on. Yeah.
Yeah, but that was all on one map.
Yes.
Well, in this case, this is on the map screen.
Okay, so eventually you're running 3 separate games of it at
more
the same
than that,
time
because
interact.
It's more than one type. There's 3 on the moon, there's 2 Arctic, and there's sort of like 5 temperate ones. So.
Oh, because they sort of did a bit of that with the previous one because you had the capability of building undersea bases as well.
Yes,
you which did, had different you? Things they made and different requirements and so on.
Haven't
yeah.
seen any undersea spaces yet, but it's a possibility. I haven't got that far because I keep getting bogged down by actually building stuff.
Yeah. I really liked the game, the previous one, and I sort of gave up because it got to a point where my economy had just massively overbalanced, and I'm just not sure how I could recover it, and it was a real pain in the backside, and I sort of wore off of it.
We'll get to the economy.
Mm.
You're placing buildings down, and they're all deliberately weird shapes. They won't tessellate. Like, you'll put down... Oh, it's on purpose.
Yeah.
You'll put down, say, a vineyard.
Yeah.
But then you have the option to put down extensions on it.
Mm-hmm.
So 4 or 5 extensions going, which all have to be in placement.
Yeah.
And also 5 upgrade buildings, which can either reduce the amount of power that it uses,
okay.
the amount of people it uses, the logistics requirements it has,
yeah.
or on some of them, the amount of money it takes to maintain.
Mm-hmm.
And so these buildings are all slightly weird, so they're not you're not going to fill every square in the most optimal way.
Oh, that would irritate me. You should see my cities in the previous game.
Yeah.
Very precise grids.
Yeah, they're not going to be that precise anymore.
Mm.
Which is it's good, it works, and it's interesting and fun, and you're building it. It doesn't stand up at all to something like Cities Skylines, which... Mm. has to
I
be the gold standard.
I know, everyone says great things about that.
So compared to that, it's just a very, very flat experience and not very dynamic. Mm. You're not worrying about traffic on individual roads as much.
Yeah.
And the areas of effect of stuff isn't as clear as it could be, or even if it's clear if it is an area of effect on a building or if it's global. Mm. So you're never quite sure what effect you're having by putting down this security centre and who's actually going to care about it. It goes off and does a couple of RTS missions if you want.
Oh, yeah, is there a combat?
I mean, which is just sailing around 3 to 6 or 7 ships.
Yeah, quite a minimal combat experience.
It's not very good.
Well, that's not really what it's about, that game. No. That's just there to add a bit of a point to the sort of military production of it all.
You're slowed... Well, there's very little military production in this game so far.
Mm.
You're slowed down by needing certain items to be able to build some of the things, and doing these missions is one way of getting it.
Right.
But the others is doing quests on your normal maps.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is, and this is the big problem,
yeah,
the economy doesn't work, to my mind.
Yeah?
It's gone wrong somewhere.
Mm.
You're building up an area. Say you're building up a bunch of people,
yep,
and they're fine at that level, at the lowest level, making you tens of thousands of credits per minute.
Mm.
Then you'll start upgrading them.
Yeah.
And the mechanisms to support them,
cost
the extra
more.
Building stuff, means you're then only making 2,000 per minute.
Yes.
And you think, why did I just waste my time upgrading these people?
Perhaps you're not meant to upgrade them. Perhaps if they're sufficiently productive to get the job done, that's you should stop there rather than... I know I did the same thing in the previous game, as I was desperately trying to make everyone as highly functional and happy as possible, and it was bankrupting me.
Yeah, and I get the feeling all the way through...
Which is why I'd be a bad leader, really. Yeah.
All the way through, I'm just thinking, why did I bother doing that?
Mm.
Have I just wasted an hour redoing my economy so that these people can get enough of that stuff?
Yeah.
Because now, while they're making 70,000 a minute in this map up there is now losing 30,000 because of the industry I've had to put up there.
Yeah,
to do
exactly.
It.
Yeah,
and I can't be bothered with that. Well, it's a constant negative feedback cycle saying, "Yeah, you're not doing very well."
Well, you upgrade the people to become more technically adept, and so on, because that's a sort of gateway to unlocking higher tiers of stuff. Now, if you don't actually need that stuff, then yeah, it's probably a mistake to educate your people. You know, if all you're after is farmers, you don't really want to be teaching them about electronics and stuff.
Which is where it all falls down, because the best way to make loads and loads of money is to take your temperate areas.
Yes. Just stuff it full of...
Turn them into housing estates.
yeah. Stuff it full of really under-educated, low-paid people.
I've just got loads and loads of basic houses, which got farms there to keep them fed, and water and power from the sea. And, yeah, it makes me loads and loads of money. And I can't touch it, because if I upgrade anything, all that money's going away.
Yeah, I mean, I got quite far up with the previous game. I was sort of developing up and getting quite highly technically adept populace, and I think I probably hit the same problem, but then the game's story dumped a whole other colony on me that was really poorly optimized, and suddenly I was losing hundreds and thousands of dollars every second, and I couldn't recover from that. I'd just be massively in debt the whole time.
Yeah, that's the thing. I can go from having 500,000 credits and be happy to them giving me a loan for 500,000 credits to keep me from going bankrupt in not very long. And it's all...
Oh, when it goes, it really goes quickly.
It's all knock-ons from me pushing forwards on the technology a bit, and then everything I'm balancing, and then having to build so much so quickly that I can't afford it.
Are you playing it too quickly? You meant to just tweak it a bit and then let it run for an hour and make sure it's all stable, then tweak it a bit more and let it run for an hour? Are you supposed to use more load saves, that sort of thing?
Yeah, possibly, but it's quite dull if you do
that. It is quite dull doing that, yeah, exactly.
See, I can't help but come away from it every time I play feeling that this game is broken, possibly intentionally, but it doesn't work as a nice economy to play.
I like it as a sort of building set more than as a sort of story-driven empire builder, you know? It's more about just tweaking about with the technology and playing with the new different types of buildings and laying out a nice little town. And you almost don't really want an overriding, massive threat-driven story to, you know, force you to industrialise quickly, because that sort of puts the pressure on and makes you screw it up.
But it doesn't even have the stuff that you need to do that properly. Like City Skylines, you can see exactly when you put down a police station, the area of the people affected by that police station.
Yes.
You can't in this. And so it's not clear. Yes, there's going to be some people connected on the road, but then there's also a global value which is fine for everyone. And
there's a sort of Does it handle it all with autonomous drones sort of zooming backwards and forwards along the roads that you don't really know? Because this is Blue Byte, isn't it? This is the same people who did the Settlers games. And the Settlers games, it was essentially, yeah, the roads. It was all about roads linking different sorts of production buildings. And but you could see quite, certainly sort of around the time of Settlers 2, you could actually see, you know, people carrying particular items along roads. Each commodity was real. It wasn't just a sort of behind-the-scenes hand wave.
Yeah.
Everything had to physically move around the map.
This has to move around, but you've just got trucks. You can't see anything.
You've got no concept. It's feedback, isn't it?
Yeah, there's no feedback or even, I think, any concept of congestion on the roads.
Yeah.
Your road design doesn't seem to matter as much as it should, although it does matter to some extent because it tells you it, but it doesn't show you
yes.
it. And it's incredibly tough.
Well,
and I think I've been spoiled by the fact that I come from the city skylines, which tells me all of this stuff explicitly.
Yeah, I mean, the certainly the Settlers, you could actually see big piles of stuff building up on road junctions. And you'd know that was where you needed to sort it out, redo some roads
yeah.
or adjust the infrastructure to sort it out. But with Anno, the previous Anno game, you couldn't really look at it and tell at a glance what needed doing. You'd have to just wait for it all to fall apart and then randomly try adjusting stuff until it seemed to work. And that sounds like a similar problem in here.
Yeah, it's a game I want to love.
Mm.
I love bits of it.
It strikes me that this is your sort of Alpha Centauri to the Anno 20 whatever series is civilization.
Yeah,
you know?
But it just doesn't quite work on any level. Every bit of it feels either a bit too dumbed down or not thought through enough or something.
Yeah.
And it just doesn't feel like it all works together.
Hmm. It certainly came out quite quickly after the previous one. Perhaps I'm.
That's a couple of years.
Yeah.
A good few years.
Yeah. Okay.
I'm not particularly happy with the way it is.
Mm. And of course, add to that Uplay.
Yeah,
presumably as a requirement, I guess.
I'm glad I didn't pay more than £27 for it.
Mm. Oh,
but
yeah.
No, I will keep going with it. But yeah, it's not the game.
It's
it
not
could
ringing
be.
True.
It could be a much better game, probably quite easily.
Missed something, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, cool. Well, that's all I've got to talk about.
That's all I've got too.
Do your spiel.
You can go along to howtomurdertime.com where you can find our previous episodes. You can also go along to our YouTube channel, which you can also like and subscribe to if you feel like it, where all our videos are and future videos will be.
Okay, cool. With that, we'll see you next time.
Goodbye.